couple of years ago, I was at San Diego Comic-Con, and J.J. Abrams was previewing something never before seen from a Star Wars movie in one theater, you know, X.
Professionally.
And there was a pilgrimage, like it was an exodus from one building to another. And it was fans maybe, I don't know, 15 wide and a half a mile long. It was the most amazing thing you've ever seen in your life. And I'm in a van. We got to get from A to B, and we have to get through this ocean of people. And I'm like, stop the van. We got shit to do too at J.J. Abrams, you know, so I got out and a couple people recognized me. And so I was able to part the sea and I hold the savages back and push them back and, you know, waving our van through. And, you know, we thanked them profusely. And then they, you know, I got out of there as they collided again. They thought that I was lucky. Later, they thought that they could have killed them if they knew that they were being held up to get a special seat at this Star Wars thing. But, you know, hey. We got stuff to do too.
Thanks for joining us one last time for Comic-Con Begins. My goodness, can you believe we're at the end of our six-part oral history of the San Diego Comic-Con? From 1970 to today, we've really taken quite a trip through geek and fan culture together. And for those who need a quick refresher, we recommend you check out episodes 1 through 5. As we made our way into the early 90s, sci-fi movies were on the rise, thanks in large part to major innovations in the realm of special effects and computer graphics. Comics, though, were in a strange place. Marvel and DC had to do what they could to keep readers interested, with gimmicks such as the infamous Death of Superman saga. Meanwhile, creators were starting to find ways of taking control of their own intellectual property and began coming together Avengers-style to establish independent companies such as Dark Horse and Fantagraphics. This included Image Comics, co-founded by our own Jim Valentino, whom you've been hearing throughout the series. The underground comics of the 60s and 70s were infused by a punk rock ethos that emboldened new creators such as Peter Bagg, Johnny Ryan, Linda Barry, Phoebe Glockner, and Hoechi Anderson to produce outstanding work that we were now calling alternative comics. All the while, we at the con continued to honor and remember the great creators of classic comics from yesteryear. We brought recognition to those who were maybe left behind or even left off the credit sheets from their own creations. One such way we did this was through what has become the Oscars of the comics field, held at the con and begun throughout the 80s. Before passing away in 2005, Will Eisner was the creator of such influential works as The Spirit. He is considered by many as the father of graphic novels and was just an all-around super guy and mentor to hundreds in the industry. It's no wonder that after a few name changes, we finally landed on the awards being known as the Eisners.
Comics and Gaming, San Diego, California. There they are.
As one of the only people who can lay claim at having been at every single Comic-Con ever held, it's no wonder, too, that our dear friend and colleague Jackie Estrada has long been the queen bee of the comics industry's most auspicious awards ceremony.
Originally, there was something called the Jack Kirby Awards, and this was in the mid-1980s, and it was something that Fantagraphics Books came up with. And the idea was to have professionals in the comic book industry vote on a slate of nominees in categories like Best Writer and Best Single Issue and Best Comic Book and things like that. And then they were announced at a program at Comic-Con. And then in 1990, Will said, yes, I will attach my name if it's a nonprofit. That's when Comic-Con took over the Eisners, and that's when I became the administrator of the Eisner Awards. And I've been doing that ever since. That's our big awards show that we now have on Friday night of Comic-Con.
like a sense of legitimacy for me now. I had my own character, my own comic book. I had been doing Usagi now for more than 35 years. And along the way, I've been honored by Comic-Con, which is a huge honor in itself. I received an Inkpot Award, nine Eisner Awards, including the Hall of Fame now. And these awards are really special to me because Comic-Con is really special to me. It was the first convention that I had ever been to and the only convention that I have attended religiously.
An Inkpot Award is an award instituted in the early years for service to Comic-Con. When Bijo got hers, it was a little loving cup from Party City or something. The current Inkpot Awards are designed by Will Eisner and are bronze. And believe me, if one of them fell on you, you could break your foot.
Comic-Con had the foresight not only to expose people to other countries, what other countries are doing in comic books, motion pictures, and anime, but they're also instrumental in honoring or bringing back the Golden Age artists, which is something I really appreciated, because just to bring out and honor the people who were there before us.
One of my biggest memories is standing next to Will Eisner at the awards ceremony. And in between, I had a chance to talk to him and eventually became friends. And there was something magical. Somebody you have admired was your idol, and now is your friend. And you can talk about anything you want. That's one of the great things that a convention did for me, is that I became friends of my idols, and I felt at home all the time.
Today, people get into comics knowing that you can get famous to a certain extent. You can go to conventions and sign autographs. You can maybe have a celebrity that transforms into some jobs and some money. A lot of older artists make their livings doing commissions for fans. When the comic book industry was not paying them a pension, their fans pay them a pension in effect by buying artwork from them and paying them to sign or draw things. And for the first generation, anybody who got into comic books before about 1970 got into the business and maybe got out without knowing that was ever a possibility. And at San Diego, these people become celebrities and they get thanked and they get honored and they get financially rewarded in some cases. There are people like Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster who were not treated very well by the industry, or Bill Finger or Jack Kirby. And there's dozens of other lesser cases of people who created great characters, and because of not knowing what they were signing, or just merely the fact that the company had such good lawyers and way more money, they were excluded from their own characters. They often didn't get credit for their work at all, or not very much. And the fact that the fans rallied around them and made them celebrities at the convention and talked about the injustices that were done to them went a long way towards righting a lot. Not all, and not enough, maybe, but a lot of those in past injustices.
At the banquet was the Spirit's own Will Eisner.
I was asked to bring samples of my artwork here. I thought maybe I could sell a few pages. They told me a big publisher was out here, a fellow named Stan Lee, who I heard does some comic books, and I thought maybe I'd sell a few pages to him. I'd like to say something serious. I've been saying that all day. And now I've got somebody to listen to me. I believe, speaking largely for the comic artists, comic books, that we are now on a threshold of a whole new era in comics. And with the rather long overdue recognition of comic art as an art form, or what I like to call sequential art, we are facing now a whole new emergence of this art form into many new things. For 35 years, comic art or comic books have devoted themselves entirely to one theme: crime does not pay. We found out that that's all wrong. There's got to be a new reordering of our intellectual editorial priorities. You hear that, Stan?
I'll get equal good.
I'm going to keep talking till you faint.
We spoke last episode about how Hollywood changed the con in the 80s. But what does Hollywood's involvement look like today with the advent of the internet and social media? Image Comics co-founder, artist, and original con contributor Jim Valentino has plenty to say about all of that.
I remember Faye Desmond, the president, I think, of Comic-Con at the time. She came up to me. I was the publisher of Image Comics, so this must have been about 1999. And she asked me if I had any problem with the convention bringing in movie and television studios to set up their stuff. And I said, no. It seems to me like they would bring people into the show. And if they bring people into the show, I can sell them my books. Fine. Yeah, sure. And I said, anyways, we've always had these people here. You know, and she's no, she's talking about a really big presence. I had no idea what she was talking about, or in those days, the fact that it would turn into Hall H and all of that. Hall H was created after the movie studios started to make a very big presence in at Comic-Con. And I think that was after the convention center expanded a bit. So as I recall, the very first year, there was a pirate ship in the middle of the floor to promote Pirates of the Caribbean. There were Star Wars vehicles, X-Wings and land speeders, full size, the actual props from the movies. Legos had this big giant thing with all their monstrous Legos. They were bringing in a lot of stars, you know, people, movie stars. Right, not just comic book stars or science fictions, but actual movie stars. Just like Charlie Lippincott did many, many years before, they realized if they could get the fans fired up, they could have a successful show. So Hall H accommodated that. Basically, it's a big stage and it's a very large hall. And all the people who want to go for movies or TV shows or premieres or to see some celebrities, actual real, you know, people like Harrison Ford, for example, they could go to Hall H and they sit in there pretty much all day. They camp out for 3 or 4 days to get in, to get a seat, and then they just stay there.
When Robert Downey Jr. made his entrance as like 50% Robert Downey Jr., 50% Iron Man, Tony Stark, I feel like that was a great research moment for me because I had spent the entire day in Hall H watching panels, making notes, recording audio where I could. And I got up in anticipation of the Marvel panel to kind of move to a different part of the room where I thought I might, just to kind of change my perspective and get a better view as people were shuffling around in and out. And I ended up moving to a place where I was kind of sat behind a pole and couldn't see anything. And the place where I was previously sitting was the aisle that he came right down. And it was just such an interesting moment in terms of thinking about Hall H and how you have this really potent feeling of like liveness and that you're there. But I actually watched that whole thing, even though I was physically there on one of the screens. So I had this meta moment of like, what am I actually getting from being here? And again, that's where, you know, it's the crowd. That's the excitement. And that's, again, the fans generating that and creating that excitement for the industry.
It really felt like it was a secret for nerdy people and geek culture and people who are of a similar mindset. It seemed like, oh, wow, yeah, these are our people and we're here and this is cool. And oh, whoa, now in the late 90s through the mid 2000s, the mainstream is sort of trying to market to us and our dollars are important. Whoa, that's cool. And it was very new and exciting. And I'll admit it, the first year that I was invited to an Entertainment Weekly party up on a rooftop, I was like, whoa, Comic-Con is going to the next level. This is incredible. But then the people on the floor started to change as well. There was always a collection of like Playboy models who were taking pictures with people even back in the 90s. But suddenly you started to see people realizing that they wanted to go down to Comic-Con in order to create content for whatever they were doing, for their YouTube channels, for television shows that were covering Comic-Con. So you got sort of what I would consider to be carpetbaggers coming in.
You know, one of the most ominous phrases I've ever heard is content creator. I'm not a fucking content creator. I'm a writer. Fuck off. You know, I mean, that's a nice way of just like de-individualizing the contributor or this creatives thing. You know, these are all slightly condescending and rather sinister corporate speak, in my opinion. You know, and we've all, any of us who have been in the arena professionally know exactly what I'm talking about. And we all get bruised and we all get hurt and we all get like used and thrown away and then picked up by someone else and used and thrown away. That's the cycle. So that's not geek culture. That's not geek culture doing that. That are the overlords.
Somebody mentioned something about Comic-Con. You'll see the complainers. And one of the big complaints is that what used to be the most obvious thing about Comic-Con, which was all the back issue bins and the, you know, all of the Golden Age and Silver Age comics on display, you know, we can't find those at Comic-Con anymore. Comic-Con doesn't care about that anymore. And that's how they came to be. And now they just don't care. So, you know, you get a lot of that sour grapes kind of thing going on. But, you know, it's, what I observe is that people resent that it became popular because they want it to be their thing. And, you know, they're upset that other people got interested in what they wanted to be their own niche thing. So they're not so excited that it became big. They're upset.
Our panels used to be prime time in the old days, right? They'd be on a time when you'd get a pretty good turnout, maybe. Now, they put a Saturday night, and it's not anybody's fault. It's just we don't draw the big crowds. So we get relegated to Saturday evening, which, as you probably know, is the big evening socially at Comic-Con. So people are not as interested in going to a trauma panel. But the good part is, if we get 500 people, those are dedicated people. Those are people who really care about us. And so there's a kind of a yin and yang to the whole thing.
There is a spirit of the original Comic-Con that's still present, but I think it's more about shared values and shared perspective. That's not necessarily the same focus or interest of the Comic-Con the way it is now. I mean, right now they're a showcase for very important companies in the industry, very important television programs, very important film projects, large comics publishers, medium-sized comics publishers. So they're catering to that now. Their focus isn't cultivating the next Scott Shaw.
My first Comic-Con, there were 15,000 people there. And I thought, this is too big. And having said that, it was wonderful. Now, I have no idea how many people come to San Diego. And of course, the tragedy now is that I don't get to meet people. I miss meeting people. I miss making friends. Everybody knew when I was young that I wore a big black leather jacket and dark glasses, which meant that if I took off the big black leather jacket and the dark glasses, I had a certain amount of anonymity. People weren't quite sure what I looked like, but I was the guy with the dark glasses and the leather jacket. And that was amazing because that would allow me just enough freedom of movement to walk the dealer's room, to walk Artist's Alley, to meet friends.
For those of you who haven't been lucky enough to attend a con, our long-running Artist's Alley is the place where creators, artists, and entrepreneurs of all kinds can come to set up their tables and booths, meet with fans, sign autographs, and hawk their wares to the public. Think of it as Comic-Con's very own flea market, minus the fleas. Being that the con remains so integral to both the commerce and lives of so many in the industry, It's no surprise that many comics creators, Hollywood insiders, and other creative professionals will quite literally schedule their entire yearly itinerary around our annual Late July event. Don't believe me? Here's Uber Geek Pro himself, Kevin Smith, to confirm.
San Diego Comic-Con functions for me like the start of my calendar year. Most people, you know, start in January and stuff. The geek year kicks off in San Diego Comic-Con and goes from con to con. So, a little comic book show that some cats decided to throw in San Diego has developed into an institution around which I center the activities of my working year. Isn't that nuts?
We plan our entire year around Comic-Con. I mean, summer is just reserved for Comic-Con. I mean, we spend like 2 or 3 weeks just preparing for this big convention. And it is a big convention. And, you know, it's, for me, I go for the comics and to meet the fans and meet other creators.
Just the visibility and the scale of industry promotion happening at the San Diego Comic-Con now, and Hollywood promotion in particular, I think there's the sense that stuff, in being so visible, has kind of taken the place of comic books at the event. But it's more like what stuff travels outside of the convention center and becomes most visible to people who aren't at Comic-Con in some ways. I think the more obvious industry presence, as opposed to just artists and writers, like comic artists and writers, but gradually, in addition to those artists and writers who would show up at Comic-Con, you also start to get more of a presence of the companies like Marvel showing up, representing the company. Eventually, you get to the point of today where if you're watching and learning about Comic-Con and seeing how it's reported in the press, it seems like that's all it is. If you're at Comic-Con and that's all you're interested in, that also seems like it's all there is. But you can also kind of seek out that other stuff at Comic-Con still today.
I had gone to a Comic-Con and there were a group of people in a little side room that were doing a reader's theater of a little Lulu comic strip. They were passing around scripts where people were reading this dialogue from this comic strip from the 1950s. I mean, so nerdy it was painful, but it was delightful. And my wife Jan took one of the parts. And if this was an old-time nerdish fandom, I don't know what it was. So maybe you might say that there were giants that were moving through Comic-Con. There were great film stars and huge blockbuster movies being presented, but there were also activities like this going on.
I created a show called The Guild. It was a web series, and I shot it in my garage for almost no money. So I went in 2008 to publicize my web series, and I literally went down there to hand out bookmarks to people at the doors. And then in 2009 and 10, we actually had our own booth and I subleased it from someone. And I actually had to put together the IKEA shelves myself. And our lines got longer and longer and longer over the years. And I think in 2008, it was still kind of a creator-friendly environment. And as the years went on and Comic-Con got more and more hyped and more mainstream, big companies started coming in and trying to co-opt the space and obviously a lot of money. So it sort of turned into something different. I feel sad when Artist Alley keeps getting infringed upon by bigger and bigger companies and more booths. And I get upset when small creators like me could never kind of break through when there are 18 Star Wars TV shows coming through. So it is different, but you just have to change with the times and find other places to celebrate the smaller voices.
Well, I created Usagi Yojimbo, or rather Usagi Yojimbo was first published in 1984. We got tables back then. We could buy a table for as little as $15 or something. And I remember sitting with Peter Laird and Kevin Eastman, creators of the Ninja Turtle. For some reason, we're kind of situated by the restroom.
But in those days, you know, we'd be at a show and they would put the funny animal guys kind of on a set of tables that nobody really wanted, usually next to the restrooms or on the way to the restroom or something. We would sit next to Stan a lot and just, you know, it was just the best because we'd be trading sketches. And I mean, I've got a sketch in my studio right over here I got from Stan in 1985 that I asked and we would trade drawings and stuff. But
Usagi and the Turtles came out, both came out in 1985. four. I think the Turtles came out in May or June. Usagi first appeared in Albedo in October, November. There were very few black and white comic books at that time. So, of course, we gravitated towards each other. We supported each other. And after the Ninja Turtles got their TV series, you know, it was red hot. They were great. Peter Laird and I were at a comic con, San Diego Con, and we're just sitting with each other, just talking. And he just turned to me and said, "Do you want a toy?" And I said, "Yo, sure." And he said, "Good, we'll include Usagi as part of the Ninja Turtle toy line. And how about in the TV series?" And of course I said, "Yeah, that sounds fine." And then he said, "Yeah, sure. Have your people call our people and they'll hash it out." The thing is, I didn't have any people. It's like, you know, I had a friend, a lawyer who did some legal work for me, but basically I had no one to do the licensing or anything, at least not on that scale. So basically they gave me some of their people.
And the reception was appropriate. Fans fell in love with Usagi Yojimbo and Space Usagi, and we published it at Mirage and did that. We also, there were now, you know, Dave Garcia was another really good friend of ours. We created a comic called PandaCon, and we were able to bring him into the turtle line, and there were others.
A lot of people had been introduced to Usagi through the Ninja Turtles, which I'm eternally grateful for, but it came about because of Comic-Con. We met each other at the San Diego Con, and we made the initial deal at the Comic-Con, so it was wonderful.
That's the best part, is meeting and making lifelong friends. I mean, Stan just moved, but for a while he didn't live too far from where we live here in Southern California, and so we'd get together pretty regularly. And the camaraderie we shared with a lot of up-and-coming creators, especially Stan Sakai, was just something that I felt like we were all on the same journey, and that was a love and appreciation for comic books, wanting to dedicate your life to a medium that it's not a get-rich-quick scheme, you know, anything like that, but we're doing it for the passion and the love for it. And when Peter and I had opportunities with the Turtles, you know, the toys that came along and the cartoon shows and things like that, that we wanted to bring some of our friends along if they wanted to. And that was one of those things that, in addition to just being artistic friends and creators, that we were also owners of our property.
I mean, every time we went back there with another movie, because they got, each subsequent film got bigger than the last, the crowds got bigger, the noise got louder, the insanity got higher, and until this point where, you know, I think we were there for, with Winter Soldier.
Marvel was announcing Winter Soldier, that they were going to make it, and we were directing it. That was the first time.
Yeah, which is interesting because, you know, you have no thumbprint in the Marvel Universe, and then you're being thrust into this insane, judgmental crowd of folks, and everyone's wondering, well, what the hell are these guys going to do with Captain America, Winter Soldier? Aren't they comedy guys?
There was a lot of anxiety in the air in that room, I thought.
Yeah. But to watch the trajectory and the love and how we got embraced over time there was the most special point of our careers. I don't know that we'll ever be able to replicate the feelings that we got showing up there to present new material to that crowd.
When I first came back after a fairly, you know, an absence of a few years, I was afraid that it would have gotten too commercialized and so on. And it was during the flush of like Marvel movies and all of that that were coming out right and left. And I mean, at first the slickness of it really did strike me, but the sweetness became very evident right away. There were still the moms with their little kids and the wonderful congregations that we'd all have, you know, in the lobby, you know, me and other artists. So it definitely had not lost its soul, even though it's got a little bit of a fever.
My most interesting exit from stage was around 2004, 2005, 2000, somewhere around there, when Dave McKean and I were doing a panel together. I think it was a Sandman panel. And we We're in the middle of this room. It was full. There were maybe 2,000 people crammed into the room. And the people whose job it was to get us to and from the panel realized there was a problem. And the problem was the way that this room was set up, they couldn't get us out without us being literally surrounded by people who would want things signed, and they had to get us to the next thing. So what they did was what anybody at Comic-Con who was inventive and brilliant would do, which is they brought in a horde of Klingons. We're talking on stage, and I'm starting to notice out of the corner of my eye that an awful lot of 6'5", 6'8", leather-clad, crinkle-foreheaded Klingons are slowly edging in on the right-hand side of the hall. And the panel finishes, and suddenly there is an armed, well, they weren't particularly armed, they were just huge. There was a wall of Klingons between us and the people who wanted us to sign something. And we were ushered out behind a Klingon wall. And that has to be the best exit from any interview I've ever done. And it's so Comic-Con. Here is your Klingon guard, because we have to get you off stage somehow.
40 years after we took our 9-year-old and our 4-year-old, who enjoyed things but didn't fully grasp it, I got to take my grown-up daughter and her son, then in his mid-teens, to Comic-Con for the first time for him, and he got his own pleasures out of it. It used to be that conventions were for the grown-ups, and now its conventions are for the family. When Joy Murchison Kelly, who was the first ghostwriter on Wonder Woman, walked through the crowds at Comic-Con, and the little girls in their Wonder Woman costumes posed with her, it was magic. The joy experienced by all has simply grown exponentially over the years. And one of the challenges for the event has been everybody wants to go.
With more than 125,000 attendees crowding into the San Diego Convention Center each year, there's obvious issues with population control at the con. Even getting a ticket can be an issue if you're not fast enough on the draw. You've probably seen the episode of The Big Bang Theory where that geeky gang had trouble getting their con credentials.
What's going on?
Hey, we're about to buy tickets for Comic-Con.
T-minus 45 seconds.
They sell out incredibly fast, but as long as one of us gets
good in... Good Lord, this is not the time for flirting. Keep it in your pants.
In 1970, our problem was worrying about whether or not we'd be able to get enough people to come. We had enough trouble even getting the word out in San Diego. Has the con now become too big for fans to comfortably make it inside?
For a while, I went with Paul Scheer for a few years, and I remember Aziz Ansari was there with us one year, and he tried to jump the line into Hall H by saying, like, hey, you know, I'm kind of famous, and I'm getting bothered out here in the line. And the security guards were not having any of it. And we're like, we don't care. Get to the back of the line. It was true, too. I mean, like, that is, ever since then, Comic-Con has taken a little bit more care with celebrities who want to go down, who don't want to be bothered. I remember the year that Jack Black went, and I think he wore a stormtrooper mask or something so that no one would know who he is and he could walk around freely. I've been down there with Jason Mantzoukas, who gets stopped a lot and has to kind of keep moving. I'm able to walk around unimpeded. I have a great level of fame where maybe like over the day, 6 to 10 people will come up and say hi, but they won't stop me or want to take a picture or anything. So that's really great.
To help reconcile this issue, when we come back from the break, we'll hear about a little film franchise called Twilight and what happened in the early 2000s when it made its presence well known at the con.
Hard
like glaring at each other like, oh my god, you smell so bad.
Sorry. He's a great guy. That's our secret.
I don't think it's as productive to just say Twilight ruined Comic-Con. If you're going to make a criticism, it's probably more productive to say that Hollywood promotion at Comic-Con in general has taken something away, if you even think that Comic-Con has been ruined by those things. With Twilight brought a very visible, vocal audience of women, young women. A lot of Twilight fans were women, and that franchise, I think, is kind of looked down upon in kind of a gendered way. So I think it's really interesting for Twilight to have caused that much of a stir at Comic-Con.
Welcome back to Comic-Con Begins. The voice you just heard was Dr. Erin Hanna, university professor and author of the book Only at Comic-Con. And the stir she is speaking of is the arguments that took place when some felt Twilight may not have belonged at the con and was seen as taking over.
Twilight! We're at Comic-Con!
But as our story has shown, this situation at the con is far from unique. Remember the issues some took with Star Trek seemingly taking over way back in 1973. So what was the big difference in 2008? The proliferation of the internet and cell phones.
We were celebrating, just starting to celebrate how big Comic-Con had gotten and how important fans were and how fandom was kind of opening up and becoming more mainstream. And then along comes Twilight at Comic-Con, and some of the reactions to Twilight's presence there becomes this total case and evidence of like pushing back against that.
I have mixed feelings about some of those fans who wait online for 3 or 4 days in the rain. I admire their determination, absolutely. But there's a level of selfishness to some of it too. Especially when Twilight was coming out, when those films were, there were thousands of people who just wanted to see what was going to be at the Twilight panel, what footage you were going to show, what members of the cast were going to be there. And for the first couple of years, until somebody figured it out and learned better, the panel was usually like 3 or 4 o'clock Saturday afternoon. And those fans would get into the room, which whether it was Hall H or you know Ballroom 20, and camp out for the entire day, waiting for their panel. They didn't care about the 5 or 6 panels that preceded theirs. They really paid no attention to what was going on stage. But they were taking seats from people who really wanted to see those panels just so they could make sure they had seats for their panel.
And I think it's really interesting that Twilight gets talked about as being this moment of a shift. Like that's when I also hear a lot of people say, like, once Twilight showed up, that's when Comic-Con kind of really sold out and started to go downhill. You know, I don't think it's interesting necessarily that Twilight showed up at Comic-Con, because I think that actually makes total sense to me. I think what's really interesting is all the discourses about it and the consternation about it. And I think that's really telling. Is Twilight, it makes sense at Comic-Con. You know, it was a huge blockbuster franchise. There's a lot of films prior to that that had been promoted at Comic-Con that were not comic book franchises.
You know, I had gone to Comic-Con every year, and I always had a hotel in the Gaslamp. And I remember the day I walked out, and there was all these middle-aged women, and they're all like in their 40s, standing in line all the way down, you know, one of those alphabet streets in the Gaslamp. And I walked there with my wife, and we're like, who the hell are these people? What are they here for? Because they weren't in cosplay. You know, I'm used to women being at conventions, obviously, but not women in their 40s. Without costumes. They were just waiting in line. And someone said it was this vampire novel. And I was like, I have no idea that this vampire novel was going to be a movie. And I was like, I have no idea what the hell this is. I did not, obviously, you know, it's a YA book. It's not aimed at me in any way, shape, or form. But I remember that being a sea change towards like seeing that, you know, not only was Comic-Con opening up to mass studio releases and stuff, but it's also opening up to a whole new audience of people who were peripherally interested in genre, right? Like, I have a feeling that Twilight, I mean, as much as it's maligned, it introduced genre to a whole lot of people, I think. And, you know, the way I always look at it is when you you bring all those people in from something else. Some of them are going to get turned on to comics. I mean, not all of them, but I've certainly seen that be, you know, a way of us getting new readers into this medium. Someone went to San Diego Comic-Con, they wanted to see the vampire writer of the YA books, whatever. And then they went, I'll go walk the floor and I'll pick up this vampire comic because I'm sort of interested in this subject now. So I think it's always been to our advantage. I think people sort of lament that in this weird way that they think their passion and dedication is being overtaken by someone else. But I always say that's horseshit. They're helping sustain the thing you love.
Comic books gave me a blueprint map of how I can present my existence in this mm-hmm. world.
And that was your experience.
Yeah, Marvel Comic Books was really key too, because it taught me something about life. It taught me that in life, and I say this to a lot of kids, define yourself with an adjective and then put yourself after it. And comic books taught me that. For instance, if I say the amazing, you'll say
Spider-Man.
If I say the incredible, you'll say
the Hulk.
If I say the invincible, you'll say
Iron Man.
And if I say the mighty, you'll say
Thor.
Right. So when I was coming to hip hop, I would say mild-mannered Catholic school. You got to understand, I'm really doing it. Mild-mannered Catholic school kid, Daryl McDaniels, when he gets on a mic, he's no longer Daryl McDaniels. He transforms into DMC, the devastating mic controller. So all of that stuff, I was able to utilize the gift of these beautiful comic books. You know what I'm
That's
saying?
Dope.
It became a part of me. There's a lot of us in the hip hop universe that are empowered and inspired by comic books.
Yeah, I agree, man. I believe that helps with our vocabulary immensely when we're writing. You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure. In kindergarten, I saw my first comic book and I just had to have it because of the way it looked. So in order to understand what the hell Tony Stark was talking about and Reed Richards was talking about and the Watcher and Galactus, it made me pay attention to school.
For a long time, the assumption was that geek culture was mostly pimply white boys who liked to read comic books under their blanket with a flashlight. And over time, there have been more women, people of color, members of the LGBT community that have come forward and said, yeah, we also read those comic books too. We also watched those films too. We also enjoyed those stories too. And what you find is that, you know, a lot of people of color especially identify with comic book characters because a lot of comic book characters are misfits. You know, they're people that are sort of marginalized by society. And so what you're seeing now is a lot of those fans who have grown up saying, well, I actually want to tell stories that are more authentic to what it was like for me growing up. You know, for me as a misfit, maybe is a little bit different than what it was for a Jack Kirby as a misfit. It's great that we've sort of created this culture where more and more voices are being able to come into the forefront. And you see, you know, the Black Panther film is an excellent example where white people will also identify with these stories. It's not just stories for people of color. These stories can resonate with anyone because they're stories well told. And people of color, women, members of the LGBT community, we've been identifying with white stories all our lives. So, you know, it's a little bit of an equalizer, I think. And I think it's a great thing for everyone.
The reason I thought Martin Luther King's life would work well in comics is, first of all, because that is the job that was given to me. I was a cartoonist. A publisher approached me and said, do you want to tell the story of King's life? When you're a cartoonist and a publisher says, do you want to do it? I mean, it's, you know, your thoughts immediately are, yes, of course, I'm going to tell King's story in words and pictures. The approach that I wanted to take to it that I thought might be a little bit unique, and I'm not sure that it was, but I hadn't come across a lot of material that took the approach, was to just to not sugarcoat who King was and to not to try to portray the myth as it had been presented to me in the 80s and in the early 90s of this saint-like figure. So I felt presenting what was perhaps a more fair and balanced, fair to King too. I don't think he wanted to be known just as some, you know, saint-like figure.
You go there and immediately you start seeing friends, cartoonists who live all over the country and later became all over the world. And it's a very small community. We are not that many in the world. And that was one of the great things, is meeting them. I remember years later giving the Input Award to a great Mexican cartoonist, one of the early founder of the comic book industry in Mexico, Ramon Valdiosera. And I had the honor to give it to him and have a panel with him. And later, when it became international, I see that my publishers in Germany, the people from France, Spain, they come to the table and they invite you to their conventions. At San Diego, I've been invited to go to India, to Malaysia, all over the world, all because the people went there and met you and they knew your work and they had the chance to talk personally with you. That's another great thing that to me, San Diego has been so important.
These are just a few examples of the innumerable ways fandom culture continues to strive to be more inclusive and to connect communities of all kinds together under the aegis of pop culture. The celebration of the arts is a celebration of humanity as a whole. It is a celebration of who we are as a people, what we can imagine, what we can create, and what we are capable of when we unite to make the impossible possible. It's no wonder scholars like Dr. Hanna, pop culture historian Cassine Gaines, and pioneering fandom academic Dr. Henry Jenkins have spent so much of their time and energy on exploring that shrinking space that exists between fan and creator. As delighted as my friends and I are that fandom has become such an intrinsic part of our society, I have to say, for us, a fan is a fan is a fan. My friends and I, we're fans. We love what we love, and it's made an incalculable difference on all of our lives these many decades later. Here's Comic-Con co-founder Barry Alfonso with more.
Believe me, the people that are around now, we're all good friends. We have no problems with each other at all. We all respect and really love each other.
It is interesting to think about the folks who were involved in the early years of Comic-Con as sort of being this strange organization of misfits who didn't quite fit in with the rest of society. And there's certainly something to that. You know, all of us were certainly parts of society. We were doing perfectly socially acceptable things. You know, I was a science major in college, for instance. But by the same token, we're doing this stuff that seems so bizarre and so out of left field that I think we can say with some confidence that the misfits who helped create Comic-Con 50 years ago, we ended up conquering the world.
If I hadn't been involved with Comic-Con, I don't think I would have made it into the business, because I got to meet almost all the living greats and Bob Kane. Bob Kane was another example of looking like, you know, picking up the rock and seeing the other side of comics. But seriously, everybody was so nice and helpful. And whatever time I invested in it was not wasted. Other than Shell, I don't remember any kind of problems between people. I really don't.
Is Shell around? That's not a valid question. Certainly Shell is around. Take one look at him.
Shell checked out. I'm taking one.
We were in Delaware, I think, when the funeral was. He was in the hospital when we were out there for one of the reunion conventions. We were there, and Richard and I were both going to go, I think, along with a couple other people to go see him in the hospital. But someone had come from the hospital from seeing him, and they told us, don't go.
He was unable to talk. He was unable to recognize me, and he was, you know, dead by many definitions already. You knew he was not going to ever be Sheldorf again. And I'm standing there trying to get him to have a flick of recognition. They had put me in gloves and a mask, and I'm saying, Shell, it's Mark Evanier. Remember Mark Evanier? And there was no response. And as I'm standing there, an orderly, a hospital orderly, who is wandering in to clean up some things, says, oh, Evanier, I loved your panel at Comic-Con the other day. And I kind of burst into tears that Shell was excluded from all that. It's a shame to take that away from him. It was the thing that Shell did that was most important in his life.
How long have you been interested in the cartoonists, that is? When did you first start getting them together, and when did you start collecting?
You really want to know? 25 years ago, I was a kid of 10, and as a hobby, I just started clipping out these newspaper strips and pasting them in scrapbooks, six dailies and a Sunday. I started with Dick Tracy, and now I've got about 10 different strips that I enjoy. The artwork is just too beautiful to throw away, so I kept them in scrapbooks in continuity through all these years.
So I'd like for you to give a huge welcome to the final Game of Thrones Comic-Con panel. We're going to bring them out right now.
Now with conventions, it's people that attend them. They're consumers consuming an event or consuming an experience or an entertainment. But in those early years when we were getting going because of the ethos and that Shell had a lot establishing, it was an event that people who attended were participants. And they were all part of the same group, whether they were a writer or an artist or a lot of the fans. They started out as fans and then they became writers. They became artists. And they felt they had a stake in it and they were really involved in it.
Today, we have social media where everybody's connected about everything. If you like 16th century French China, you can find 100 other people who are interested in 16th century French China. In 1970, I mean, we, all of us comic fans, were mostly alone. Maybe we exchanged mail, or maybe we got on the phone with somebody once in a while, but it was a solitary thing. So creating community through Comic-Con, through all of these other activities, was just hugely important. 1974 was the first Comic-Con I attended, San Diego Comic-Con. To walk into a room and there are thousands of comics, unbelievable, overwhelming. And to be in a room with a whole bunch of people like that, man, it made you feel like not an outsider for a change. It made you feel like part of something that was actually happening and not just the freak or the geek.
I mean, there's a lot of people now that are on salary with Comic-Con, you know, so in that sense, they're not making profit at it. It's still nonprofit, but they're getting a living out of it. But they have to, because it, you know, an event that size, you can't do it. At least I don't know how you could do it on just a volunteer basis and have any kind of continuity and stability.
The San Diego convention opened yesterday and already it's in high gear. There's something for everyone who's ever read a comic book, from big little books of the 30s to Superman, that still ranks number one today. Shell Dorff, founder of the local get-together of comic book buffs, says this week may break all attendance records. Superheroes are everywhere, but so are customers. And that's one major reason for the convention, share and share alike, for a profit, of course. If a 1946 issue of Donald Duck in fine condition can bring $150, it's only natural that the first Donald Duck comic drawn by artist Carl Barks in 1942 would go for just $850. Bill Emerson says he came all the way from New York, and this pirate gold issue is a duplicate in his collection. That's what customers and dealers stress: age and condition. It's almost like being at a stamp collector's convention. There's even a catalog, and books are rated good, fine, or mint. And that could push the price from $350 to $900.
It was definitely a labor of love, because we weren't getting paid and we were putting quite a lot of time into it. We would have meetings periodically. When I was doing the dances on stage, I would prepare for almost an entire year for the next year's masquerade. Every other weekend, I would have rehearsals. A lot of times we would be in some private space that I could find. Sometimes we did it on the steps at San Diego State University, wherever there was space. All the girls had to be responsible for their own costumes. That cost money. And, you know, just basically so much time we put into this, but we didn't think about it. Somehow we were able to go to college. I was able to make straight A's, and I was able to spend so much of my free time devoted to the convention. And it's amazing now. I certainly wish I had that kind of time on my hands.
It's curious to think that as big a business as Comic-Con is today, and people often ask, well, how much money did you end up making off of any of this? And the answer was not a dime, because to be perfectly honest, it never occurred to us at the time that this could be anything that could ever make any money. And it never occurred to us that in any sense we were entitled to any sort of compensation for this. That's certainly something that, in retrospect, never entered my mind whatsoever. I was just so excited that we were doing this sort of stuff and making it available to people that the notion that there'd be any sort of profit motive to it, frankly, never entered my young head at the time.
I'd love it if they'd hire me as Moa's consultants so we could get some money to make our lives a little easier. I mean, we're living on Social Security, basically. And I lost a job I had recently, and she's no longer managing fast food places and is a driver for non-emergency medical vans. And, you know, we get by, but we're not living the high life. Ask us for ideas. We got lots of ideas and lots of suggestions. And it would be worth their while to do that, and it sure would help us.
When it stops being fun, then I won't do it anymore. So far, I'm still having fun. Getting older is mandatory. Growing up is entirely optional.
No, I think that everybody is fun to fool around with. I think we should all put on a costume. I think the clothes we wear today are very drab. I think we should all put on superhero costumes and have a real fine time. I think we ought to wear reds and nice blues and rich colors and have a great time. And, you know, just wear what we want to wear. And I don't see why I have to wear a tie or I have to wear a formal suit and a lot of other guys have to look like penguins, you know, just because it's called for. I think we ought to have a good time, you know. Why not? It's the only thing I can think of. Why not? So, you know, the other guy hasn't got a tie. I'm not going to run to Emily Post and say, I want to report him.
Well, the 50th anniversary in 2019 was the first con I had attended for 10 years, and it was huge, and it was great, and it was fun. I guess the bad part was that there were a few people who were missing, you know, because we all age and we all, you know, pass away eventually. So there were some people that were obviously missing. Other than that, you know, there was a whole new generation of people there that were doing the same things that we used to do. So it was good.
We were just a bunch of goofy teenagers in the 60s and 70s when we came together to create the San Diego Comic-Con. Back before we even had a name we could stick to. Back before anyone had even heard of San Diego. We had no idea the work we were doing to put on the con each year would lead to where we are now. We did it for the love of the game. Science fiction, fantasy, comics, cartoons, magic, costuming. They were our passions, not our careers. For many of us, we were lucky enough to make our passions our business these many years later. We were lucky to stick it out long enough to see the con grow into what it's become, with all its ineffable advantages and disadvantages, its wonderful contradictions that make it the biggest pop culture gathering on the planet year after year. While some of us became creative professionals, others went on to achieve other goals. For all of us, though, there's no question Comic-Con was our special little place that we're so proud to now share with the entire human race. We're proud that it continues to endure, flourish, and evolve. We're proud that you're here to watch with us as the journey continues forward.
One of the things that people have asked me is, well, what was it about those early 70s conventions that made you want to get involved? And I would say just the nicest people. The nicest people.
Long live the Comic-Con. Peace.
I don't know where we'll be in a year or two, but I would think that wherever we are, it's going to be at a most exciting plateau. And I hope that you're all going to be there with us. Now, let me close by saying that if you enjoyed this half as much as I do and did, you had a really good time. So I want to compliment you on your choice of speakers. And with one final excelsior. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
Just hit the power button, right?
This has been another episode of Comic-Con Begins, an original SiriusXM podcast. Created and directed by Matthew Klickstein. Executive produced by Rob Schulte. Written and produced by Matthew Klickstein, Rob Schulte, and Christopher Tyler. Edited by Rob Schulte and Christopher Tyler. Mixed by James Bilodeau. Original music composed by Max DiVincenzo, produced by Foxtrax Music. With special liaison to SiriusXM, Brannon Getchess, and historical consultant Wendy Aw. Archival material and additional research provided by Mike Towery and his Comic-Con Memories website, Alan Light's 1975 Comic-Con recordings, Jackie Estrada and Comic-Con's 40th anniversary souvenir book, Pamela Jackson and San Diego State University's Comic-Con Kids Project, Maureen Cavanaugh at San Diego's KPBS, Mark Evanier, Scott Shaw, Barry Alfonso, Bill Lund, Erin Hanna and her book Only at Comic-Con, the works of Bill Shelley, and me, your host, Brink Stevens. We obviously had many other people working tirelessly on this project behind the scenes, not to mention our nearly 100 contributing interviewees, too large in number to list here. So we ask you to take a moment to check out the fuller list of credits on our description page. Thank you kindly, and from all of us at Comic-Con Begins, stay fantastic. Bye now.